Hi, this is Austin Hill. Hey, thanks for checking out this podcast from Austin Hill in the Morning. Now, you can hear our program live weekday morning, 6 till 8 Central Time. There are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows. They're available online. Our web address, of course, myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Start your day connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the Morning.
Good morning. Welcome to Tuesday from the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill, honored to have you with us. I'm here weekday morning 6 till 8 as we seek to be informative, hopeful, helpful, and challenging right here at the beginning of your day. Hey, some real good news, something, a very positive development to start off the day with. Today marks the opening, as I understand it, the first release of the motion picture, The Dropbox. And I'll tell you, I'm not a big movie guy. I'm just not a big movie person. I know a lot of people are, and that's why we have Bob Waliszewski from the Plugged In Movie Review that joins us on our program on a fairly frequent basis, because he can supply expertise that I don't have. I learn from him every time we're in a conversation, and I'm not a big movie guy. Every once in a while, however, there is a motion picture that gets released into the marketplace, and it's a must-see for me, and then I go to see it, and in the case of a film that I saw back just shortly before Christmas, Exodus, Gods and Kings. I recommended that. We talked a fair amount about that here on the program, and after I saw that, I just wanted to come back and tell you, go see this film. There were mixed reviews on that one, but that was just my opinion. The Dropbox is a motion picture that tells an amazing story, and we're going to let you hear just a little bit of a conversation we had recently on the program with the director, the guy, the writer, the young man who was the whole moving force behind getting this motion picture shot. He is a young man from the Los Angeles area, and here's kind of how the story goes, just in a thumbnail sketch. He was a undergraduate student studying motion picture production at USC, University of Southern California. He wanders into a coffee shop one day, and a coffee house. And here's this guy, I think he was all 20, 21 years old, and he picks up a hard copy newspaper. Now that's kind of that should be sort of not a red flag, but that should tell you something's underfoot here, right? Because how many people in their 20s actually even know that hard copy newspapers exist, right? And their whole world is all online. Anyway, he picks up a newspaper, reads about this amazing pastor in South Korea. And from there, the young man says, I've got to go do a documentary film about this guy. And everything I've seen, the little excerpts that I've seen, it's just stunning. The Dropbox, a motion picture coming to theaters across the country. We'll tell you about this, let you hear some of the conversation with the film's producer coming up in just a few moments. Also, we had, you may have caught this at the top of the hour from our news source, SRN Radio News in the from the anchor, a pretty amazing development, I would say, within the Southern Baptist Convention church denomination. The president of the Southern Baptist Convention, Ronald Floyd is the gentleman's name. He has authored and published what is being described an open letter to President Obama, calling on the president to use his power to forcefully confront the threat that is the Islamic State. And I report this to you as good news. My friend, my brother, my sister, our fellow Christians are starting to wake up. In fact, Ronald Floyd, Ronnie Floyd as they call him, the president of the Southern Baptist Convention, he goes so far as to say that the world has never seen a threat to the social order and to civilization like the Islamic State, not since the days of the Nazis in World War II. And that's, I got to believe that's, and I'll get into some more of the details a little bit later this morning, but I got to believe this choice to publish this open letter to the president has been done with a lot of prayer. It's been a long time coming. It's been slow in the making. And I believe that the Southern Baptist leaders have been very slow and deliberate and thoughtful, intentional, if you will, leading up to this moment. You don't call out the President of the United States and say, please, Mr. President, would you focus your attention on this, and do it in such a big public way. unless there's really, really something that you believe is missing. And I hope this is a even a further call to prayer for all of us and a sobering moment. But anyway, we'll get into some more of the details of this very public open letter to the president from Ronald Floyd from the Southern Baptist Convention. Get to that a little bit later this morning. Also, in just about half an hour from now, we will open up the phone lines here at Faith Radio and talk about what I think is a very significant moral and ethical dilemma before us here in the country. It has to do with religious liberty, yes, the ability of one to exercise their faith and not just to have Christian beliefs, but actually to exercise and act on them. I do believe that there are some of our fellow Christians who believe that other Christians need the government to limit the exercise of their Christian faith. Some religious views and beliefs should be illegal. And there is a movement underfoot in our country to determine that that is the case. I'll tell you about it coming up in about half an hour from now, and we'll get some phone calls going, all right? Get your opinion. I'll ask for your input, your opinion, coming up in about 30 minutes. When we return, you'll meet Brian Ivey, the director, the producer, the young man behind the Dropbox motion picture. We'll tell you all about it, let you hear it next on the Faith Radio Network. It's now 6:09, and I'm Austin Hill. Central Time from the Faith Radio Network, and I'm Austin Hill, honored to have you with us, and I'm honored to be with you, weekday morning 6 till 8. Brian Ivey is a name that I think is rapidly becoming, maybe not a household name, but it's becoming certainly more familiar to more and more Christians across the world. He's the young man who is the producer, the director, and all of the above with this motion picture called The Dropbox, which is opening up in theaters here in the United States. Wanted to play for you an excerpt of my conversation with him from last week. Here's from last Friday. Here's just a little bit of what we discussed. Roll it, please. So you read this article in the hard copy of the Los Angeles Times, and what happened?
Well, I read an article. The bottom of the front page, it was a picture of a man holding a baby inside of a little hatch. And the article is called South Korean Pastor Tends an Unwanted Flock. And it was all about this man in Korea who had built a mailbox for abandoned babies.
Mm-hmm.
And not just any babies, but babies specifically with disabilities and deformities who were, quote-unquote, the most disposable children in the world. And immediately, of course, as you probably are feeling when you read that, is there's a gut check of why should this exist? You know, what are we supposed to do with this information? But I remember thinking, if I don't do something about this, everyone's going to forget. And I'm probably going to forget because this is just a newspaper, and that's what we do with newspapers, right? We forget and throw them away.
Sure.
And so I sent an email out to the pastor in Korea, and about a month later he got back to me and said, I don't know what it means to make a documentary film about my life exactly, but you can come live with me if you want. And so I responded, see you soon. And a few months later, me and my friends were on our way to Seoul, South Korea.
Very interesting. Brian Ivey, the producer of the Dropbox motion picture, he's on our guest line here on the Faith Radio Network telling us his story of a matter that happened to him while he was an undergraduate student at the University of Southern California. You moved to Seoul, South Korea. I presume that disrupted your schooling and just about everything else, correct?
That is correct. It was. I'd never been out of the country, really, except for a cruise to Mexico, which doesn't count. So it was shocking, and especially when most people thought I was going to North Korea, which would have been another issue entirely.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not that, and but I knew I wanted to be in their world, and if I was going to tell their story, I wanted to get sick when the kids got sick, and I wanted to live in their home and do it the right way.
Very interesting. I want to make this observation here. This is very, I would say, kind of counterintuitive for a lot of undergraduate college students to actually desire to live with those who are deemed undesirable, to suffer with those who are suffering, and to disrupt all your personal plans and uproot yourself from all the conveniences and the routine of living in the big city of Southern California and go to a faraway place. What prompted you to make all those changes in your life?
I really didn't feel like I had any other choice. You know, it was like being a filmmaker. I tried to quit, you know. I tried to quit like I tried try to quit smoking, you know what I mean? You really try to shake it until you can't anymore and feel like it's something you're meant to do. And at the time, I believed that everything happened for a reason, you know, easy believism. I had a vague sense of spirituality, those things. But I wouldn't find out till I actually got there that something much bigger was going on, that I really did need to and was meant to be there.
Brian Ivey, producer of the Dropbox film, on our guest line here on the Faith Radio Network. So you get to Seoul, South Korea. You meet up with this pastor, and something much bigger than you anticipated awaited you. What'd you find?
Well, I became a Christian while making the film, which I did not expect, because, to be honest with you, I thought I was a Christian. Because I didn't smoke cigarettes, and I watched Fox News with my mom. You know, it was Christianity was decorative to me. It was a label. It was a social club, a sign-up list. And I think it is a lot to a lot of people. But that's really not what Christianity is at all. It's actually coming to the realization that you need to be saved from your sin and from hell. And I didn't believe those things before. And that's what we call pride. I don't need God. I don't need to be saved. I don't need rescue. I'm fine. I can handle it on my own. I'll figure it out. I'll build my own ladder of good works, the whole thing. But realizing this, seeing these kids with all their brokenness, because a lot of them had these disabilities, deformities, God revealed all my own brokenness inside my own heart, my pornography addiction, the emotional abuse I was doing to women, the rage that I had in me, and it broke me to pieces. And yet, at the same time, when I started to hate myself for my sin, I really felt the adopting love, the fatherly love of God to say, I still want you, and that's why I sent my son. Because I want you, and that's what my love means for you.
That was my conversation from last Friday with Brian Ivey. You can hear that full discussion on our website at myfaithradio.com. You can also get links and info on this amazing new motion picture. I've only seen little bits and pieces. I want to see this whole thing. It's called The Dropbox. A pastor in Seoul, South Korea creates a Dropbox, literally, where abandoned, unwanted children are dropped off. Children with deformities, with imperfections, with flaws. There's the director, the producer of the film, saying as he produced this documentary, he had to come face to face with his own imperfection and flaws. The Dropbox film at myfaithradio.com. It's 6:17. I'm Austin Hill. This is Faith Radio. We're glad you're with us. Welcome to Tuesday.
Your day started connecting faith to life. Back to Austin Hill in the morning.
Hey, good morning. It's now 6:19 Central Time from the Faith Radio Network. And I'm Austin Hill, honored to have you with us. Coming up later this morning, later into the 7 o'clock hour, we are visited once again by our great friend Abdu Murray. Abdu Murray, author of the book Grand Central Question. Abdu Murray, of course, is a Christian apologist, a man with a fascinating background. Professionally, he practices law today. He is an attorney in the Detroit, Michigan area. He was raised as a Muslim, became an evangelical Christian, and now writes and speaks quite eloquently indeed with his own nonprofit organization. He's also very much involved with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. We know and love Pastor Ravi Zacharias here at Faith Radio. And it be that as it may, Abdu Murray addresses these issues of competing religious traditions, shall we say, how they are similar, how they are complementary to one another, how they are inconsistent with one another, and really points the truth of the Christian gospel in the midst of an ever-increasingly pluralistic world where different ideologies and worldviews collide at times. He's been with us several times over the last many months, almost a year now, here on this program, offering his insight about how best to understand Islam and radical Islam. Are they one and the same? And how do we make sense of this? He'll join us coming up into the 7 o'clock hour. He's got a lot of interesting things to say about atheism, and the appeal of atheism, and the appeal of radical Islam, and the appeal of all kinds of different Christians might think of as foreign worldviews or unusual belief systems. He talks about their appeal here in our society. and has some rather, I won't say alarming, but rather eye-opening things to say about that. So I hope you'll join us and stay with us into the 7 o'clock hour. Abdu Mori joins us at that time. Coming up in just a few minutes, about 15 minutes from now, we'll go to the phones. Our phone number is 877-933-2484, 877-933-2484. And we'll talk about whether or not you believe Christians need to be limited by governments here in the U.S. in terms of the exercise of their Christian faith. We have this rather striking scenario playing out in the state of Washington, and I touched on it just a little bit, actually, last week here on the program. It has to do with a lady named Baronell Stutzman. Baronell Stutzman. And she's a 70-year-old lady and still working, not retired. She's still working, and she is a mother and a grandmother and helps raise her grandkids and runs her own flower shop in the small town of Richland, Washington. And last week, a couple of people chimed in on this situation. She was asked to provide flowers to a man's same-sex wedding ceremony. And this was a man who'd been a client of hers, a customer of hers for many, many years. He'd been in and out of the shop, and she'd sold flowers to him for years. But when he stepped in, he said, "I'd like for you to come out and decorate my gay wedding with flowers." And she said, "You know, that's just something I'm not going to be comfortable with. I'm sorry, I can't do that." Well, this has been playing out for many, many months now, and the entire government of the state of Washington now is raining down on her. And she's amassing fines day after day after day because she refuses to say, "No, I will not compromise. My Christian belief says that I cannot participate in a gay wedding ceremony, and I will not be forced to do this." And so the 70-year-old grandmother is really threatened with losing all of her life savings, not just her store, not just her business, but really all of her life savings. And we touched on this a little bit, and a couple of guests weighed in on this. A gentleman from the American Family Association, a nonprofit family advocacy group, spoke with us about this last week. Also, an attorney named Alex Kincaid, who consults to and represents churches and small businesses in all kinds of legal conflicts. Alex Kincaid was on our program last week and offering some advice as far as what business owners and churches alike can do to try to protect themselves and prepare for these kinds of very legally damaging and dangerous sorts of situations. I have had some email from Faith Radio listeners nonetheless saying, "Well, it should be illegal. This woman should not be allowed to exercise her Christian moral conscience in such a way so as to not participate in the same-sex wedding. This should be illegal. We need the government to step in and limit how a Christian woman like Baronell Stutzman can think and believe and act on her religious conscience." And so I will pose that question to you. I mean, are some Christian beliefs just so socially unacceptable that they need to be made illegal here in our country? Do we need the government, the state attorney general, the police department, whatever it is, do we need the government to step in and make sure that some Christians don't think and act in ways that are unacceptable? Now, just briefly, before we go to a break here, Aaron, if we have that audio from Nagme Abedini ready to go, I want to put this whole dilemma in the state of Washington. This is just a local flower shop in small-town America, okay? But I do believe this whole dilemma belongs in the broader category of thought that we oftentimes refer to as religious liberty or religious freedom. And over the weekend, we had a lady named Nagme Abedini, who is the wife of an American Christian imprisoned pastor, Saeed Abedini. She spoke to a group of Americans about this very issue of religious liberty. Here she is talking about her husband, who's behind bars in a very brutal prison in Tehran. And this young woman, I'd say she's young, she's probably early 40s, but this woman is an American by birth, but her family came here from Iran. Here's what she has to say about religious liberty. Here's Nagme Abedini from Saturday.
Something I always say is that I'm proud to be an American because America gave me the choice to choose Jesus. And I hope and I pray that that's something we can continue to have religious freedom is a core value that I believe that we've steered away from. And I believe the world is watching on where we stand on religious freedom issues. And there's been a lot of silence.
A lot of silence indeed. Now, I do believe that the evangelical community in the United States is beginning to wake up. And I think probably a majority of us would say, hey, Pastor Saeed should not be held in prison because of his Christian faith, not even in Iran. But a little lady running a flower shop in the state of Washington, should religious liberty be something that she can exercise? And I'm not so sure that there is unanimous belief that she should exercise her belief in such a way. This is according to her moral conscience. She's exercising her belief in such a way as to say, I just can't participate in a same-sex wedding ceremony. How far should Christian religious belief and the exercise of Christian faith, how far should that go? We'll have that conversation coming up just about 10 minutes. It's now 6:27 from the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Glad you're here. The Faith Radio Network, and I'm Austin Hill, honored to be with you weekday mornings 6 till 8. Weekdays at 12 noon Central Time, it's the Connecting Faith Program. Yesterday, host Neil Stavem welcomed author and counselor Leslie Vernick to talk about her book, The Emotionally Destructive Marriage. Here's part of that discussion.
It is important to differentiate the difference between a disappointing marriage, which happens in a lot of Christian homes, a difficult marriage, which is true of many homes as well, and a destructive marriage, because there are subtle but very, very important differences. So a disappointing marriage is what I say to people is nobody gets all 52 cards in the deck. So when you marry somebody, there are going to be some cards missing. So you might marry a guy who's really handy around the house and he can fix the bathrooms and can do all the repairs, but he can't have a deep conversation and doesn't want to read a book with you to save his life. You know, he just doesn't have those qualities and he doesn't want to do it. Or you might marry a guy who's really good at deep conversation and loves to have a conversation, but if the toilet was overflowing and, you know, and there was water coming down into your living room because of it, he wouldn't know what to do. And so not everyone marries someone, and nobody marries anyone who's got every quality that you would like or want. And so sometimes part of marriage is learning to live with the person that you married, who the real person is, not the person who you thought they were. And that's the adjustment phase for many, many individuals. And sometimes we have this idea that, oh, you weren't who I thought you were, and so now I'm going to find someone else. That's not a legitimate reason for getting divorced. That's not a good reason for breaking a relationship. And during that time of disappointment, it's often the opportunity for us to learn to love in a deeper way. So I'm not talking about that kind of marriage here. The second kind of marriage is a difficult marriage where there's, I would describe that as a lot of external stressors, like maybe it's children who have autism or special needs. You have financial issues, job loss. Maybe you have some personality or cultural differences that you're trying to work through, or family of origin create some outside stressors with in-law problems, moving a lot. All of those kind of things create problems in a marriage. And if a couple can be mature and learn to navigate those in a mutually respectful and caring way, difficult does not have to turn into disappointing, although it could if you don't handle it well. But a destructive marriage is very different. A destructive relationship goes beyond disappointing and difficult. Here's how I would summarize it. A destructive relationship is a pattern, not just a one-time event, but it's a pattern in which one person in the relationship is regularly dominated, deceived, dismissed, degraded, or diminished. And so there's this lack of mutual effort at maintaining or repairing the relationship. There's a lack of accountability for the wrongs or the wounds that have been caused. And a relationship that when someone brings it up, that this is a problem, they're often denied, I didn't do that, you're crazy, minimized, you're making too much of this, you're too sensitive, or blamed on the other person. It's your fault that I acted this way, because if only you would be a better wife, I wouldn't act this way. And so we see this pattern happening over and over again, and that's what's so destructive.
Author Leslie Vernick being interviewed by Neil Stavem on the Connecting Faith program. Coming up on today's episode, Neil will interview University of Northwestern St. Paul Bible professor Dr. Mark Muska. They'll talk about Dr. Mark's book, 50 Things You Need to Know About Satan and Demons. 12 noon, Central Time, Connecting Faith with host Neil Stavem here on the Faith Radio Network.
Good morning. It's 6:32. How far should religious liberty go for Christians in the United States? And should some exercises of Christian freedom be illegal? We'll get your calls on that coming up. SRN News on the way next.
Back to Austin Hill in the morning. Join the conversation by calling 877-933-2484.
Hey, good morning. It's now 6:37 Central Time from the Faith Radio Network. I am Austin Hill, honored to be with you. Weekday morning, 6 till 8, as we seek to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful here at the start of the day. Got a question for you. How far should our Christian religious liberties go in the United States of America? And should there be limits on the degree to which somebody can exercise their Christian conscience? Now, here's our phone number. It's toll-free, 877-933-2484, 877-933-2484. Should some Christian practice just be made illegal here in the United States? Maybe that's another way to ask it. But here's why I ask. We have this rather extraordinary situation in the state of Washington. We've talked a little bit about it. We just had a couple of discussions, a couple of guest interviews, weighing in on this one last week on two separate days. But it involves a lady named Baronelle Stutzman. Baronelle, I'll just go by her first name, Baronelle. She is a 70-year-old lady. She is a mom. She's a grandmother. And very busy in the lives of her grandchildren, she is, but she also owns and operates her own flower shop. She has her own business. She's a small business owner. How often have you heard me talk about the goodness of owning and operating a small business, right? Well, here is an example of just that. She's in the small town of Richland, Washington, as I said, and she has had this particular gentleman, this particular man, come into her flower shop over the past several years. I think it's been about a decade, as I understand it, and he buys flowers periodically, kind of a regular customer. And they have a friendship, apparently, and a good relationship. But back about 3 years ago, he came to her and said, I am a gay man. I am marrying my male significant other, and I'd like for your shop to basically cater my wedding service and come out and decorate the chapel with flowers. And at that point, that's where she said, you know, I love you. I think you're a terrific guy, and I appreciate our friendship, but I am not comfortable with this. My religious practice, my Christian faith will not allow me to participate in a gay wedding. Well, from that, this client, who heretofore had been a very successful and, I guess, it was a good customer-client relationship, he became very upset, as one might imagine, and starts posting things about her on Facebook. From there, we are told, the state attorney general in Washington saw these things on Facebook and launched a full-fledged state investigation of little Baronelle's flower shop in Richland, Washington. She is now incurring fines, as I understand it, every day because of her refusal to cater to a gay wedding. And she's standing her ground and saying, I'm sorry, this could cost me my business. It could cost me all my life savings. It could cost me every material possession I have. But my Christian conscience will not allow me to participate in a gay wedding. And I would just wonder, a couple of folks weighed in on this one last week. One of them was an attorney, a lady who's a former prosecutor from the state of Washington. She now practices private practice law. She consults to churches and Christian business owners on how to legally protect themselves from these kinds of things, among others. But her name is Alexandra Kincaid. She just goes by Alex Kincaid. She was on our program last week. In fact, this is just a little bit of what Alexandra Kincaid said to me and to you, the listener, on, I believe it was Thursday's broadcast here on our morning program. Anyway, a little excerpt from Alex Kincaid, and here she is describing what she thinks this dilemma with Baronelle in Washington, what it means not only biblically but constitutionally. Listen to this.
Hi, Austin. Thanks for having me.
Good to be with you. You've watched this unfold. You're pretty close to Ms. Stutzman and the situation with her flower shop, Arlene's Flower Shop, there in Richland, Washington, I believe is the town.
What has been your impression as you've watched these details unfold?
Well, you know, one thing is clear, and that is that this movement is strong. People are organized. They're going forward. And we in the Christian community need to be aware of that and plan for it in our businesses. So, you know, this is an event where someone's faith is being challenged in terms of being able to act on it. In fact, that's what the Superior Court judge said. Our religious beliefs are protected, but not necessarily our actions based on those beliefs. And this is extremely concerning for us in the Christian community.
That is exactly how other people have analyzed this. They're saying, well, okay, this judge in the state of Washington has affirmed that one can believe as they will, but don't act as you will according to those beliefs. Some beliefs are just socially unacceptable, I guess. Is that a correct interpretation, would you say?
I would say it is, which flies in the face of our First Amendment, you know, our very first item in the Bill of Rights. This is why America became America in the first place, so that we could have free exercise of our religious belief. And I emphasize that free exercise portion, which includes taking action, not just having the belief.
So, and again, that's Alex Kincaid, an attorney and former prosecutor who advises churches these days and Christian business owners. Should Baronelle, should her right to freely exercise her Christian faith, should that be protected? Or would you say her understanding, her acting on her conscience, exercising her Christian faith in the way that she's choosing to, should be illegal? I don't believe that there is unanimous agreement among the evangelical community that this denial, this choice that Baronelle has made to say, I'm not going to participate in a same-sex wedding. I don't believe there's agreement that should be acceptable. I think there's plenty of our brothers and sisters, and perhaps you feel this way, and I respectfully ask you to please let me know about that. Weigh in and explain why. I do believe there are plenty of our brothers and sisters who would look at this and say, absolutely, we should all be forced to attend and participate in gay weddings when asked to. This is hateful, and this is judgmental to not participate in a gay wedding. And this kind of Christian practice should be made illegal. So let's have that conversation. Let's talk about it right now. It's 877-933-2484, 877-933-2484. And by the way, I'm not asking these questions here simply because I'm trying to be controversial. This is a significant moral and ethical dilemma facing Christians, really facing all people in the world and all people in our country. But it is of, I think, particular significance to Christians in America. And what we're doing here, this is kind of, you know, if you've ever taken an ethics class in college or maybe in grad school, if you're a pastor and you were a seminary student, you had to take an ethics class or something like that. This is kind of how we do ethical analysis, okay? This is an ethical dilemma in our pathway, and it's worth talking about. 877-933-2484. To the phones, Robert is up next in Fargo, North Dakota. Robert, welcome to the program, sir.
Good morning, Austin.
Welcome. What are you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking that the right to refuse service to anyone should be a right of a personal property, and it's a right to that person to choose whether or not they want to allow someone to do business with them.
Mm-hmm.
Businesses don't have to do business with everybody. And if you're a business owner that's been in business a long time, and I've talked to a lot of them, and they say that they enjoy doing business, but one thing they do not enjoy is doing business with people that they don't like or that they don't feel have the same principles as themselves. I feel, in addition, that the state has no right to hold a license and collect fees on something they shouldn't even be involved in, such as marriage. Marriage is between a man and a woman and their God. And that is a very simple deal in my mind.
If your state of South Dakota or any other state or any other city or county or what have you, if governments across our country were not licensing marriage, do you think these kinds of problems, like the one that this lady in the state of Washington is dealing with, would dissipate? They may not go away completely. The tension may not go away completely, but do you think they would be lessened if the government wasn't trying to license marriages?
I believe that they'd be almost non-existent at all. They wouldn't be a problem like that. We'd all have that right, that personal property that we have the ability to buy and sell. We can sell in a business situation to people that we want to. We shouldn't have to tell people why we want to sell property to someone or why we don't.
All right, Robert, I appreciate the call. Thanks very much. Here's our number. It's 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. Get back to more of your calls on the way next. It's 6:46 Central Time. This is Faith Radio, and I'm Austin Hill. It's 6:49 Central Time from Faith Radio. I'm Austin Hill as we contemplate a Christian lady from the town of Richland, Washington, who is being punished rather severely by the state government there because she chooses not to participate in a gay wedding ceremony. She's a flower shop owner. She's been asked to supply flowers to same-sex marriages, marriage ceremonies, and she's saying no. Let me just be very clear where I stand on this. And this is a finer point of what we're talking about here. I can't imagine being in this situation. I've never owned and operated a service business of this type, like a flower shop business. I personally, and I know I've gotten a lot of email from people who said, oh, why doesn't she just supply the flowers and move on and let go of it and just get it done? I will tell you that on some level, that's my inclination. I don't know how I'd respond to the situation if I were in it, because I never have been. But my instinct is to think that I don't believe that my relationship with our Lord would be compromised if I supplied flowers to a same-sex wedding ceremony. I probably wouldn't want to attend the ceremony, but showing up and decorating, I'd probably be okay with that, and I'd move on. But that's not the point. This is not about my feelings, my situations. This is about another individual, a lady named Baronelle from Richland, Washington. And I, at the same time, while I think I would choose differently than her, I also stand and I support her right to follow her Christian conscience as she sees fit. And sometimes when we actually affirm people and say, yes, you are free to exercise your faith and discern God's will for your life in ways that don't necessarily agree with my own thoughts on the matter, sometimes we get an outcome that we don't necessarily agree with. Do we stand up for religious liberty even when we necessarily don't agree with the outcome? That's a part of the dilemma. To the phones, it's 877-933-2484. Linda is up next in Minnetonka. Linda, thanks for holding. You're on with Austin Hill. It's Faith Radio.
Yeah, good morning. I guess I don't know how I would do it, because I don't own a small business either.
Right.
But where do you draw the line? And I was reading an article not too long ago about a gentleman who spoke about this, and he said, if I would do it, he said, I would just say I'd be happy to do it, but all the proceeds will be going to Alliance Defending Freedom or something like that, because our freedoms are being taken away. And I don't think anybody has the right to tell me who I should deal with as far as any type of service. And that includes the government.
Yeah, that's what I'm with you on that. And Linda, I appreciate what you're observing there. Our freedoms are being stripped away. By the way, I've had other people say, well, you know, sure, agree to sell the flowers to the couple, the same-sex couple that's getting married, but then donate the profits. Well, okay, so now if we do that, and again, somebody should be free to do that. I understand that if they so choose. But when you do that, you've now created an incentive for the Alliance Defense Fund or your church, whatever nonprofit group that is receiving the funds. You've now created an economic incentive for them on their part for you to do more same-sex weddings. We have to think about the outcomes, and if we choose this, what does it produce as a result? You got to think, we all have to think through this very, very carefully. Deb is up next in Watertown, Wisconsin. Thanks for holding, Deb. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Austin. I want to point out something that both your previous callers have said. It should be a right to not do business with someone. That's not the issue here at all. The issue is not who the customer is. I'm not sure that we have a right to say, I won't serve you because I don't like you. That goes back to basic respect for human beings. She clearly has not said, I will not serve you to this gentleman. She said, I cannot participate in this activity, mm-hmm. which God says very clearly is sin. It's not about who we serve. And it's been portrayed that way in the media sometimes, that it's Christians want to not have to provide services to homosexuals. That's not what it's about. It's about the particular service that they're asking the Christian to provide, which is contrary to their conscience. Who is the issue.
And what I hear you saying, Deb, if I'm understanding you correctly, is this is about the exercise, the free exercise of Christian conscience with the business owner herself.
Yes.
I think you're spot on with that, and I think we've lost an adequate grasp of that. And listen, I appreciate the call. Great to have you listening in Wisconsin. But this is profoundly important. Again, I would probably choose to handle this situation differently than our sister in Christ, Baronel, in the state of Washington. Maybe you would choose differently as well. But do you stand with her freedom? Do you support her freedom to exercise her Christian conscience as best as she understands it, even if it produces a different outcome? Sam is up next in Minneapolis. Sam, thanks for holding, sir. Welcome.
Thank you, Austin. I just have more of a general idea. It seems a lot of areas of Christianity gets attacked, and it's all about holding your ground or your personal faith. And I believe, for me, it's all about your personal walk with the Lord and what is okay for you and what is not. I know everyone has a different point of sin. Just take, for example, a man watching a Victoria's Secret commercial. One person's fine with it, the other person, it spirals them into lust. I believe everybody has a different conscience and opinion and what is right and wrong in their head according to God's word and according to the Holy Spirit, and I believe that it's our duty to uphold that and to support other Christians in their answer in that way.
So do you support this lady, the flower shop owner in Washington, and her right to choose not to do business, or do you not?
I would support her. It's a fine line between all these new upcomings in our world, and but I would rather support a Christian in that instead of leaving them out to dry. And I don't know her personally. I'm sure it'd be a lot different.
I don't know her personally, and I suspect most of us in this.
Yeah, but from the general sense of what I'm understanding, it seems like she's an upright woman and is doing the best she can and is trying to do it with the most tact she can in this situation, and it's an impossible situation in our culture today.
It's very challenging. Sam, I appreciate the call. I don't think it's impossible, but it is very challenging, and we need to have thoughtful conversations like this. We have to think through these things. This is really a matter of kind of applied Christian ethics. We can agree on following Christ. We can agree on what Scripture teaches. How do you apply it in everyday situations? That's a challenge. We'll continue in just moments. This is Faith Radio. I'm Austin Hill.
Start your day connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the Morning.
Good morning and welcome. Tuesday underway from the Faith Radio Network. And I'm Austin Hill, honored to have you with us weekday morning 6 till 8 as we seek to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful right here at the start of your day. Do atheists and radical Islamists and other people of other different kinds of worldviews and ideologies, do they have an appeal in our world today? They most certainly do, according to our great friend Abdu Murray. Abdu Murray will join us in about half an hour from now. If you've never heard this man before, I do hope you'll make sure to be here at approximately 7:35 Central Time. Abdu Murray is an intriguing man. He practices law. He's an attorney in the city of Detroit, Michigan, which, by the way, is the most Islamic city in the United States of America today. He was raised as a Muslim. He is an American. He is an evangelical Christian. He's doing a lot of speaking and a lot of work with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries these days, which is quite fascinating. And Abdu Murray is, is the best I've encountered as far as people who can help explain why it is that radical Islam seems to have such tremendous appeal to suburban kids in America and in Canada, in other suburban and middle-class sorts of regions of the world, like in parts of Europe and such. He also is very clear to say atheism as a belief system, if you will. Atheism has enormous appeal to our kids. As a matter of fact, he's gone so far as to say here on this program that if you're a pastor or a youth pastor and you don't think that young people, kids, young adults in your church are susceptible to the appeal put before them, the alleged appeal anyway, of atheism and radical Islam, you're naive. Abdu Murray joins us at about half an hour from now to talk about the appeal of other worldviews and belief systems coming up at about 7:35 this morning. You've heard some about it in our newscast that we get at the top and the bottom of the hour from our great friends at SRN Radio News, our news carrier here on Faith Radio. You'll see, if you pay attention to any news headlines at all, you'll see and hear discussions about the Federal Affordable Care Act, sometimes abbreviated ACA, and more often than not just nicknamed the Obamacare Law. That's what President Barack Obama calls it, and that's what I call it. You'll see and hear news about the Obamacare Law being under scrutiny yet again at the United States Supreme Court. There is, it seems to me anyway, and as a journalist, I've followed this. Last year wrote several news stories about the claims being made before the Supreme Court, the claim being that the individual states and the federal government itself has not followed the correct wording of the law, and therefore the administering, the doling out of taxpayer-funded subsidies, the free health care that some people are receiving from Obamacare, is illegal. The bill, the law, was poorly written, they say, and the federal government and the states aren't following it correctly. What can we expect as the Obamacare law goes under the microscope yet again at the United States Supreme Court? Coming up, an expert from the Heritage Foundation breaks it down for us. We'll talk about that next as we continue. It's now 7:08 Central Time. This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. We're glad you're with us.
News you can use. Connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the Morning.
Good morning. It's now 7:09 Central Time from the Faith Radio Network. Sometimes it's a challenge keeping up with the acronyms and the nicknames and the technical names that we hear bantered around in news stories. This placing and scrutinizing the Obamacare law at the Supreme Court, you may hear this described as the King versus Burwell case, which there's a good reason for that. You'll hear it described in a variety of different ways, but at its core, lawsuits have been brought to bear, and the case is now before the Supreme Court to determine, is the federal government following the law that the Congress and the President brought to bear. Joining us to give us some analysis of this, John Malcolm. He is an expert in such things. He works with the nonprofit Heritage Foundation Educational and Policy Research Group in Washington, D.C. John Malcolm, welcome to Faith Radio. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on, Austin.
What a mess, but you're the guy that sorts it out and makes sense of it. Where do we begin to wrap our minds around the scrutiny of the Obamacare law yet again at the Supreme Court?
Well, this is a very important case. It's unlike the last two. The first was the constitutional challenge, the NFIB versus Sebelius, and then there was the Hobby Lobby case, which dealt with the religious accommodation. Mm-hmm. This is a statutory interpretation case. So when the federal government set up Obamacare, over vociferous objection from virtually every Republican in Congress, it relied on people purchasing insurance through exchanges. And the people who envisioned Obamacare envisioned that the states would run these exchanges, and they offered the states various carrots and sticks in order to try to induce them to do so, since they couldn't force them to do so without those carrots and sticks. And one of the carrots that they offered was to offer tax credit subsidies to the citizens of those states who purchased insurance on an exchange established by a state. And that is the key. There's a provision that provides for these tax credit subsidies when the insurance is purchased on an exchange, quote, established by the state.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened was over 30 states rejected that bargain and decided not to set up state-run exchanges. So the federal government, as a backstop, stepped in and now operates a federal exchange in those states. The question now becomes whether that tax credit subsidy is available to citizens in states where the federal exchange is in operation. The law pretty clearly states that it has to be an exchange established by the state, but the Internal Revenue Service, at the request of the administration, said, no, this is really a term of art. It's all very vague, and because it's a vague law, we're going to interpret that law to provide tax credit subsidies for citizens that purchase insurance on the federal exchange. Four people from Virginia, which operates a federal exchange, have challenged that law, and that is what the Supreme Court will decide, is what those terms established by the state meant in that provision of Obamacare.
There is this tendency, I think, among some, John Malcolm, at the Heritage Foundation, to say, oh, come on, this is so detailed and so fussy, and why are we being so particular? We know what was intended here, and why do we have to, you know, mince words and slice and dice the language? This is just people who don't like the president or what have you. People are being helped by Obamacare. Let's just move on. I've heard that, and I suspect you probably have heard this as well. The Supreme Court apparently thinks that it's more serious than that. And I've had some attorneys, some state legislators that I've spoken with in different regions of the country say that if the federal court upends this and says, hey, the federal government never authorized itself to do this, they're violating their own law here. People who have received some of those subsidies, as you describe them, hey, they're going to have to pay this back. The states will have to reimburse the federal government, and individuals will have to pay back the states or the feds or whoever. This, if it's deemed that this money was distributed illegally, it has to be paid back. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, this technicality, as you call it, or as critics call it, is we're talking about billions of dollars, and it's not only billions of dollars in tax credit subsidies. But along with those subsidies also come the mandates, the individual mandate and the employer mandate. And those mandates are severely weakened if the plaintiffs prevail in this case, which, of course, you know, critics of the law believe will help to drive down the cost of insurance. Look, the court should engage in what it does all the time, which is a matter of statutory construction, and the consequences of that statutory construction really should be left to Congress and the President. The President would be forced to go back to the negotiating table, which he, of course, doesn't want to do. You made the point that critics say, oh, well, everybody knows what was meant here, that Congress, and they mean by that, that Congress always meant for everybody to receive the subsidies. The answer to that is, well, there's certainly nothing in the legislative history that indicates that that is the case, that this was a special inducement offered to the states so that they would take on the cost and burden of running the exchanges. And, in fact, one could very easily make the argument, look, if the subsidies were going to be available to citizens, whether they purchase any the insurance on a federal exchange or a state exchange, then why would any state ever set up a state-run exchange? There's a huge burden and a huge cost and political risks, risk of failures by running a state exchange. And if this tax credit subsidy was going to be available regardless, virtually every state would have sat there and said, well, then you go ahead and run it. And
sure,
that is something the federal government desperately didn't want to have happen.
John Malcolm, final question. For those of us who really do care about the individual person and individual families, we want them to receive the health care resources they need. We may disagree on how that happens and the distribution of such services.
Right.
Are people potentially at risk for losing their health insurance over this Supreme Court case? And if so, what do you tell them?
Well, I certainly think that there will be some people, at least temporarily, who will lose a tax credit subsidy. I do believe that that will eventually drive down the cost of insurance when the mandates go away, that we will have more of a private sector influence, and that, you know, the states will step up and try to care for the needy who live in their, within their borders.
John Malcolm, he is an analyst at the Heritage Foundation, a nonprofit think tank and a research and education group in the Washington, D.C. area, helping us understand what in the world this scrutiny, yet again, of the federal Obamacare law at the Supreme Court is all about. John Malcolm, thanks very much for joining us. We appreciate your time, sir.
Thanks for having me on.
Good to be with you. It's now 7:16 Central Time from Faith Radio. Abdu Murray, our guest in about 20 minutes from now, apologist and a great educator that he is, talking about the appeal of radical Islam and atheism to Americans. Why would that be? We'll have that conversation forthcoming. This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. From the Faith Radio Network. Good morning and welcome. I am Austin Hill, honored to be with you weekday morning 6 till 8 as we seek to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful here at the start of your day. Breakpoints with John Stone Street and Eric Metaxas coming up just about 7 minutes from now. And great friend Abdu Murray, author of the book Grand Central Question. He's, I just found out about this, a couple of weeks ago or so. Abdu Murray is doing a lot of speaking engagements these days with the Ravi Zacharias International Ministry Group. We know and love Ravi Zacharias here at Faith Radio. You probably do as well. But Abdu Murray joining us to talk about the appeal of atheism and radical Islam and a whole bunch of other different kinds of worldviews and ideologies, even to Americans. And Abdu is very thoughtful, very sensitive, but forthright all at the same time to say that, you know, in some ways, these other belief systems are purporting to address the issues of the person's soul, the issues of the individual heart, in ways that Christianity is just not conveying. Very interesting. He's gotten into this before. I hope you'll stick around. He'll be with us in just about 15 minutes from now. You've heard about it in our top of the hour and bottom of the hour newscast from our friends at SRN News. Benjamin Netanyahu. Benjamin Netanyahu. I have to be careful not to allow my American English accent to override a correct pronunciation of the Hebrew name, right? Benjamin Netanyahu. He is the Prime Minister of the Nation of Israel, and he is in the United States. He's here right now. He was speaking at a pro-Israel nonprofit group in, I believe it's in New York City yesterday. He will be speaking before a joint session of the U.S. House of Representatives and the United States Senate in our United States Congress today. You've probably heard about this and heard how controversial this is. He accepted an invitation by members of Congress to speak in Washington, D.C., while President Barack Obama did not want him here. And here's part of his speech from yesterday. I suspect this is a little bit of a preview of what he'll be saying in Washington, D.C. later this week. Here's part one of Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday.
Reports of the demise of the Israeli-U.S. relations is not only premature, they're just wrong.
He was very complimentary and very supportive of President Obama. Benjamin Netanyahu went on further to state this.
Our alliance is stronger than ever. It's going to get even stronger in the coming years.
The tension, however, lies in the fact that President Barack Obama and his administration is negotiating some sort of treaty. We don't even know all the details of this. The message that we have been getting from the president and our Secretary of State, John Kerry, is just trust us, we know what we're doing. There's been some kind of secretive deal being worked out with the nation of Iran, whereby Iran would be permitted in this treaty, permitted to get the full blessing of the United States to begin using nuclear power for electrical power generation. Now, the argument goes, and I'm trying to just kind of break this down into little bullet points here because it's very complex and it's difficult to follow. But the argument is, well, listen, Iran should be allowed to have nuclear reactors generating power in their country just as well as any other country should. Those who oppose this idea say Iran is not to be trusted. They will take this nuclear technology and make bombs with it, and they have reiterated for decades their plan, their intention, to obliterate, to destroy the nation of Israel. And then you connect that, combine that with the fact that historically, and things are changing, and you may be a part of this change, you may not agree with this at all, but historically, in the United States in particular and elsewhere in the Western world, evangelical Christians have believed that their country, wherever they're living, in the U.S. or Western Europe or what have you, their country should be supportive of Israel because there are scriptural commands to support Israel. The reasoning goes, and there's a legitimate theological debate. I'm not saying that, I'm not forcing this on anybody. But the argument goes among more theologically conservative persons in the U.S., at least over the course of my lifetime, the argument has been, the scripture says that nations that will bless Israel will in turn be blessed by God. And I can still think of my own father-in-law, my wife's dad, who's very elderly and very ill. He's well into his 90s, but he's a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary. He's a former pastor, retired pastor, very conservative theological seminary that he went to. And when I was a young man, just dating my wife, he would often lament the day that may come in America where we don't, quote-unquote, stand with Israel, that we don't bless Israel. And suggested to me, and again, this is just one person's opinion. It's widely shared, but not quite as widely shared as it used to be. But the belief is that if the U.S. does not support Israel in its foreign policy, God's blessing on our country will be removed. That's kind of, in a nutshell, sort of how these things are played out. Well, there are fewer and fewer American Christians, I suspect, who actually believe that strongly in Israel. And the approach now, and I will give the Obama administration their credit. They're trying to get the U.S. out of this Iran versus Israel tension. I really do believe that's the case. Trying to say, look, Iran, you beef up your nuclear operations. Israel, you do the same. We're checking out. We're not going to be in the middle of this. You folks figure it out yourself. But we can't get out of this dilemma that the United States has been in for decades, about half a century now, if we choose one side over the other. So that's kind of the moral dilemma that we're facing in a nutshell. Anyway, that said, Benjamin Netanyahu, invited by members of Congress and folks with private nonprofit groups here in the U.S. to come speak to our country, despite the president not wanting him here in the first place. You'll be hearing a whole lot more and seeing a whole lot more about this in the coming days. And we'll follow it for you as the week progresses here on Faith Radio. It's now 7:25 Central Time from the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Thank you for being here. Breakpoint with John Stone Street and Eric Metaxas on the way next. Don't go away. Good morning. It's now 7:36 Central Time from the Faith Radio Network. I am Austin Hill. Honored to be with you weekday mornings 6 till 8 as we seek to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful here at the start of your day. Who am I? What's my real, true identity? What's the meaning of life? What is the purpose of our human existence? What lies ahead for all of us in death? Those kinds of questions are often described as existential questions, questions that really get to the core of what it is to be human or not to be human, pretty far-reaching and pretty deep questions. My next guest, who's really no guest at all, he's no stranger certainly, he's authored a book called Grand Central Question. He also speaks with the Ravi Zacharias International Ministry on these and other important subjects. Raised in Islam, today he is an evangelical Christian and a Christian apologist. And he's actually been on the program before and has said that group identities and ideologies and philosophies like radical Islam tend to try and address those deep questions, sometimes better than the church does. Abdu Murray joins us on our guest line once again here on Faith Radio to talk further. Abdu, welcome back to the program. Good to talk to you.
Awesome. It's a pleasure. Good to talk to you, too.
Existential questions, the deep questions about the meaning of our lives. You've said before that radical Islam and other worldviews, other philosophies, seek to address those issues, while sometimes the church skirts the issue. Tell us about that.
Oh, sure. These are all four of these questions are what I call, you know, the fundamental questions, and each one of our worldviews is trying to answer them. In fact, if any worldview doesn't answer all four questions and doesn't answer all four questions not only comprehensively but coherently, then that worldview really, you know, shouldn't have our allegiance. It's just some thoughts that are put together randomly. And surprisingly enough, even the most developed systems, religious systems, and even non-religious systems, try to answer all four. But it's been my contention as I've seen these different ones that they haven't really answered all four in a cohesive way. Now, I think that that there are churches out there that are doing a great job of trying to espouse and tell us these worldviews, but for the most part, and it will answer these questions, but for the most part, we're not focusing on all four questions. And that's unfortunate because I think the church has the message that answers all four questions. You know, how do we get here? Why are we here? Why is here the way it is? And how do we get out of here, so to speak? We have the answers to those questions, and we have the best answers. And I think that those answers are the ones we can offer to our, especially to our non-Christian friends.
How does the worldview of atheism offer an appealing answer to any of those questions? I mean, and I say this realizing that right here where our network is headquartered in the Twin Cities, we have a very robust atheist society, atheist advocacy groups in the state of Minnesota and here in the Twin Cities, and they're proliferating all over the country. But what is the appeal of atheism with these deep questions?
Well, I'm not... The appeal, there's two parts of it. There's the answers they give, and then there's the appeal to the answers they give. I think part of the appeal is based in the human need for autonomy, the human need to sort of like define our own destinies and these kind of things and figure out who we are on our own and, you know, we're the masters of our own little universe. I think that's the appeal. But the problem is that there is a... For example, in secular humanism is really the worldview face of atheism. Most atheists are secular humanists, though not all of them are, and it certainly is the case that most humanists are atheists. When you look at what the worldview of secular humanism actually is, you can get it right from the name, secular humanism. Humanism is the idea that human beings have essential value and objective value. But secular, we don't need God to tell us that, that somehow we just have this value. And if you look at all the creeds and manifestos and various statements by atheist organizations, they'll tell you that there is a need for a shared collective of morality, and we discover these things ourselves, but every human being is valuable and has an essential dignity and worth. In the book, what I try to point out is that's a statement that I affirm, too. And that every Christian can affirm, yes, we all have essential value and intrinsic worth.
I was just thinking that. Yes, go ahead.
But you need a objective moral standard to make that claim. I'm very happy that atheists are moral people. I'm very happy that they have this moral center. But the problem is that they don't have a grounding, a philosophical grounding, to make that statement. that what they wish was true about human value is only true if there is a God. And in fact, my contention is if there's a God who is the God of the Bible. I mean, when you ask a secular humanist, well, how do we get here? The first two questions, how do we get here and what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
You have to ask, what the point of being here is something that we create. It is a subjective meaning. We don't have an objective purpose, because an objective purpose means a purpose that that happens because, or we, that we have because there is, it doesn't depend on human opinion. Something is objectively true if it doesn't depend on human opinion. And for the atheist, it has to depend on human opinion because we're the only game in town. Sort of the Protagoras statement from some days past.
Human beings are the only game
in
town.
Things.
Right.
Well, the problem with that inherently is that we're bad, historically very bad, at determining human value. Whose value are we talking about? The value of Pol Pot or of Mao Zedong or the value of Mother Teresa? Or, you know, the British Humanist Association.
Mm-hmm.
It's very tough to determine who's right and who's wrong here on an objective basis because there is no objective standard.
Yeah, as you're describing,
it's objective, and so I think you need God for that.
Right, yeah, it would certainly seem that way. Abdu Murray, author of Grand Central Question, he's on our guest line here on Faith Radio. It's intriguing as you spell this out, Abdu, and you say, well, listen, humanists believe in the dignity of all persons, all individual human beings, and yet in societies like some that you mentioned, the culture that was tyrannized by Pol Pot, or even in Hitler's Germany for that matter, in societies where God is locked out, so to speak, that are deemed to be secular, you get things like the aborting of the unborn or the slaughter of specific people groups, Jews in the case of the Third Reich. I mean, you get this philosophy that says we're all dignified and we have intrinsic worth, but some are have more intrinsic worth than others if God is not in the picture. I think that's what you're telling us.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, and you see it even working out in our day. It's not just the sort of recent history regimes of third world countries or whatever it might be. You actually have it in our day. Consider the fact, for example, that this idea that value is not intrinsic just because you're a person. Now, that's an old idea. The Romans didn't give you value just because you were born. That word person comes from Latin meaning persona, meaning mask. It was put on you by someone else. And only after the Christian burst on the scene, only after Christianity burst on the scene, did you see inequality amongst all people, because Jesus says we're all equally sinners, yet we're all equally redeemable. We have all equal value in and of ourselves because of the Imago Dei. The problem is that if you don't hold on to that view, what you end up is what modern-day philosophers and ethicists like Peter Singer out of Princeton University, he says and he argues that we don't have value just because we're born. We only have the value that other people place on us. So, for example, he argues that parents should be able to abort or kill their newborn babies up to a certain age, not preborn.
Mm-hmm.
Newborn babies. And he's not alone in this. Francesca Minerva and Alberto Giubilini are two medical ethicists out of Australia who make this very same argument, that because babies can't give value to themselves, only the parents can. Parents can murder their children up to a certain age because they don't have value intrinsically,
mm-hmm.
only what someone else gives them. And that's not a sort of a doomsday, you know, sky is falling kind of a statement. This is actually argued in our medical journals, in our ethics classes in this very country.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, it's happening. It's not a forecast of things to come. It's our present reality. Abdu Murray, author of the book Grand Central Question, breaking it down for us. Why would the secular humanist or atheistic worldview have appeal to people, even suburban kids in America, for that matter? And why would radical Islam have appeal to suburban individuals in the United States, or urban people, for that matter? Why the appeal? And is the church really, truly answering some of these deeper questions that are common among all human beings? We'll talk further with Abdu in just moments. It's now 7:46 Central Time. It's Faith Radio.
Back to Austin Hill in the morning. Questions or comments for the show? You can leave them on our show page at myfaithradio.com.
It's 7:48 Central Time from the Faith Radio Network. I am Austin Hill, honored to have you with us weekday morning, 6 till 8. Abdu Murray, author of Grand Central Question. He's also a speaker with the Ravi Zacharias International Ministry. He's on our guest line here on Faith Radio. He's written a very striking piece. We've got it on our website. It's called How Christianity Answers Essential Questions, the deep, what some people would call existential questions of our lives. It's questions about our existence. Why are we here? What are we supposed to do while we're here? How do we leave this earth? And where do we go in its aftermath? Abdu, you've written that indeed our Christian faith addresses these deeper issues, but you've also said here on the program, in no uncertain terms, that oftentimes churches in our culture, and youth ministry in particular, oftentimes doesn't begin to address these kinds of things. And that creates a vacuum, an emptiness with young people in particular. Tell us more about that.
Oh, sure. Now, I think our churches and our youth programs are doing a fine job in lots of ways. My goodness, when you think about what churches and pastors have to deal with, how many things they have to deal with, it's no wonder that they sort of flounder in their efforts to try to do their best to answer some of these questions, given the limited time constraints and all the obligations they have.
Sure.
But there is the reality that a lot of these kids, a lot of youth, for example, are asking the toughest questions. I do a lot of speaking at the Q&A sessions. Almost everyone who asks the questions are people who are 25 and younger, and they ask some of the deepest, deepest questions. I've been surprised by the 12-year-olds who have asked sophisticated questions. One of the things that they're not doing, now part of this is because they're not asking their youth pastor because of whatever reasons it might be. Maybe that's they're involved in the details or the community aspects of what it means to be in youth ministry. But sometimes they are. And I get a lot of calls from youth pastors who say, can you meet with these folks for me and with me on some of these questions? They're asking the deep existential questions. Sometimes they're afraid to ask. Sometimes they're not asking their parents or their pastors because they either distrust in some way or they feel like if I ask, this might be too hard. And what if they don't have an answer for me?
Mm-hmm.
So they linger in this doubt, not because they haven't asked because there aren't answers. They're just a little afraid that maybe the people who are an authority in my life or who are people who I would trust don't have an answer to the seemingly tough question. The problem is someone's going to answer them. In the age of an internet, where anybody can get to anybody at any time, someone's going to answer these questions for them. And we need to be ready to be able to answer these questions before someone else does, because rest assured, someone else is trying to.
And that's the crux of the issue. Somebody else is trying to. I have to tell you, just briefly, after one of our recent discussions, I believe it was back in November, one day you were on the program here, Abdu Murray, and you had addressed this issue that young people in particular have very deep, thoughtful questions in their souls that don't get answered in the church. And later that afternoon, I was driving home from school through ice and snow. My 16-year-old son and a group of his peers, another teenage young man, age 16, and two young girls, age 16 and 15, respectively. All four of them come from very devout, regular, evangelical church-attending families. I know all the parents. They're great folks. But I just threw out this question. Does the church answer the deeper questions of human existence? And unanimously, all four of the young people, my son included, although my son's answer was a little nuanced, but all three of these young people said, no, the church wants to tell us we just accept things on faith, don't ask anything further. And that's kind of where the conversation ends. That was a very enlightening experience for me, and it sounds like you experienced that a lot in your speaking engagements with young people.
I do, and you know, it's funny because even people who are seasoned Christians will use that word, faith, and I think sometimes we misunderstand it. We've let the culture, the non-Christian culture, define our terms for us. And in fact, when you look at the way the Bible actually uses the word faith and defines the word faith, you will never see an instance where God asks us to trust him absent any evidence. Every single time he asks us to trust him, it's because he's delivered something that will prove to us that he's worthy of our trust. And of course, he's more than worthy of our trust. And that's because the word faith in the Greek actually means trust. It means active trust. And you see that it's always based on something God has done. The instances in the Bible over and over again where God says, test me in this, and you'll see that I will do what I said I will do. But he almost always asks us to do that based on what he's already done. And because the Christian faith is so rich in evidence, both scientific and historical and even philosophical and existential, when you're asked to trust God, I trust God to do what he says he will do because of what he already has done and because of the knowledge I have of what he already has done, specifically the creation of the world and even more specifically the resurrection from the dead of Jesus. And people always ask me, well, why do you trust Jesus? And my answer is very simple. Jesus rose from the dead and God...
Oops, we were on a roll. Phone dropped out. Boy, we were on a roll. I was just riveted with every word he had to say. Well, see if we can get Abdu Murray back on the line, and we'll try to reconnect if we can. As you can tell, I hope you were as captivated by his remarks as I was. I'm supposed to be hosting the show. I'm just taking it all in. Abdu Murray, he is the author of a book called Grand Central Question. He is now these days working with the Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. These are very, very profound profound times that we live in and profound issues that he's addressing. And note what Abdu said a few moments ago. Young people especially have these questions. This is normal and part of adolescent development, a part of one's life growing into adulthood. If we, as the adults, are not stepping up and trying to, as best as we can, address these questions and answer them, we must, as Abdu Murray said, rest assured there are other groups from other philosophical vantage points, some of which are very dangerous and very harmful. There are others in the Internet age that will seek to answer our kids' questions for them. Abdu Murray, author of Grand Central Question. Tell you what, let's take a... Aaron, should we take a quick break here, final break? No? Okay. Aaron's getting angry with me now. He's trying to get Abdu back on the phone here. Okay. Be that as it may, this piece that Abdu has written, How Christianity Answers Essential Questions, you can find that at myfaithradio.com and info on Abdu and his book as well at myfaithradio.com. And you can also go back and find this previous discussion that we had with Abdu back in, we had one in November and one in December as well. Some rather striking comments he made, indeed. And we invited him to the program to address the appeal, the apparent appeal of radical Islam to Western youth, young people living in the United States and in Canada and other parts of what we would recognize as the Western world, Western Europe and Australia, New Zealand and elsewhere. We brought Abdu into the program back in the fourth quarter of last year to address this. And the appeal is real. It's really serious, and the appeal is there. We've got to begin addressing these issues of the heart in a more effective ways, in more forthright ways. And for some of us, and listen, that conversation I was characterizing with my teenage son and some of his friends in the car, that was a wake up call to me to make sure that I'm doing my part as a dad to address these deeper issues. For some of us, this means getting tooled up, schooled up, if you will, in better ways ourselves. That's going to wrap it up for today's edition of our program. We call it Austin Hill in the Morning. I'm honored to have you with us. Coming up tomorrow, more on this dilemma that we see playing out in the state of Washington, a Christian business owner facing bankruptcy because she is acting on her Christian moral conscience. And we'll ponder that further. Also, our great friend Bill English with BibleandBusiness.com. He'll be joining us for our regular Wednesday discussion on faith and business. All this and more just ahead tomorrow morning at 6. Have a great day. Hope you'll keep it right here. It's the Faith Radio Network. Thanks for listening to this podcast from Austin Hill in the Morning. For more information about this, you can visit Austin Hill in the Morning, our program page, on myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com.